passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And we are live. Hello, everybody. It is John Pollock here, along with Bruce Lord, who is stepping in for Wei Ting. And Bruce, we have like 100 things to go through on this episode of Dynamite. So thank you for joining me. Like many Wednesday nights, my head is spinning. So forgive me, but here we are. Thank you for joining me.
You're definitely not the only one. I mean, it's a lot to get through, as if, you know, filling in for Wei wasn't enough of a tall order. And then there's the fact that I'm coming in kind of in like the bathroom break spot, like right after a really hot Nate Milton spot on Monday. But I guess that sort of balances out. You know, you had a mediocre show on Monday that needed to be brought up by Nate. And then, you know, you've got a pretty hot show here that's probably going to be cooled down by me. Let's be honest.
So. I think everyone is looking forward to hearing all of your thoughts on tonight's show. I will say this, and it's one of the many thoughts I had watching this program, is that we have Battle of the Belts coming up on Saturday night, and the idea is these, you know, quarterly big events in the style of a Clash of the Champions or a Saturday night's main event. Bruce, I think it's really hard to get people up for these kinds of specials when tonight was your weekly Dynamite show. Like, this was an incredibly deep card we had tonight. But it just seems like there's no way that your 1 hour on Saturday can compare to the lineup you had tonight that this audience is regularly exposed to.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you've got that at the exact same time as the NJPW show, coming after a live Rampage the night before, which is going to have a title match. I think we got two more matches announced for the Saturday AEW show, I should clarify. Maybe two-thirds of the way through this show. I mean, I remember last time I wrote up the review on post for the last Battle of the Belts, and I was sort of thinking like, oh, geez, it's a week beforehand, and I only know one match. It's now, you know, 3 days before that card on Saturday, and we've just finally found out what's going to be on there. I kind of feel like, and we'll probably talk a little bit about the kind of ROH adjacent stuff that was happening here, but until the ROH situation kind of settles in, or we get a sense of what's happening there, there's just going to be a lot of matches, a lot of moving parts, and a lot of maybe these kind of somewhat hastily put together cards that AEW viewers are going to have to contend with.
Tonight had to have been the record for the Excalibur push at the end of the show, because he had three cards to promote, and I counted between matches and announcements that he had to plug, 12 things that they had to promote for Rampage, Battle of the Belts, and then pretty much a full lineup for next Wednesday on top of it. It was just one thing after the other, with an angle involving Thunder Rosa and Nyla Rose. At that point, I was just, my head was spinning, and I was just trying to furiously type.
He has his hands full, and, you know, he still was able to manage that incredible Taz November to Remember pool. But all anybody is going to be talking about, I'm sure, is him just, you know, flubbing on Kaze Nina Ray when JR just asked him to translate that live on air. So, poor guy, you know, he's... but no, I mean, I think a show like this really... really highlights how valuable a presence that someone like that, who can keep all of those things organized during a live broadcast while also making those deep historical pulls and still pretty much covering the play-by-play. It's, yeah, he has his hands full, definitely.
So we are going to get into Dynamite, a packed edition of the show from the UNO Lakefront Arena in New Orleans, Louisiana. WrestleTix today had it at around like 3,500 tickets that were out for the show. And, you know, not the biggest AEW Dynamite crowd, but again, like this just continues the streak of some incredible crowds that they have been getting. And this was 3,500 that sounded like triple that. It was just a red hot audience for the majority of the show. They were pretty hot for this.
Absolutely. They really, really showed up. I'm glad that you had the number of pre-sold tickets, because I was kind of wondering if the last minute announcement of or addition of Punk and Penta was maybe to sort of, you know, get some last minute walk-up tickets being sold.
Yeah, that was as of this afternoon. So I don't know if maybe the number ends up being a little bit higher tonight with a walk-up. Certainly, this was a card that I would say if you were on the fence about, it was a pretty compelling card to want to go and check out. And that is the match that began things with CM Punk taking on Penta Oscuro. And the idea here is that Punk is ranked fifth and Penta is fourth. And for those curious, the others ahead of them from third all the way up to first are Frankie Kazarian, Sammy Guevara, and then Adam Cole is ranked first. So maybe charting a bit of a path for CM Punk as he is moving towards this title match. But immediately, this crowd, they're going back and forth with chants for a pretty long period of time here. So already setting the scene, and they get into a chop battle. We get a Fried Takayama reference, and then they just go to an AEW chant. Like this crowd, they were here for a good time, and they got a hell of an opener here. Penta targets the ankle and knee of Punk, which would come into play throughout this. Punk avoided a tope suicida and then hit his own, and we come back, and there's a spot where Punk looks to be going for a Frankensteiner off the top and did not come anywhere close to hitting this, and just slips and crashes. And I mean, this totally looked like a mess up, but he instinctually just grabs his knee that he had been selling. And this is something we always talk about, Bruce, is that sometimes, you know, mistakes will happen and it's the reaction that you can turn it into a positive. And I did not see this as some glaring error that interrupted the match.
Oh, no, absolutely. This became the story of the match, at least from Punk's perspective. And he was working this into pretty much all of the offense and counters that he would work for the remainder of the match. It was all to do with him selling that knee, to the point that I was kind of almost, if we're talking about the whole, you know, no mistakes in improv thing, I was kind of waiting for Penta to do a little bit more yes and sort of start targeting the knee a little bit more explicitly. But I still think Punk did a fantastic job there. This was really, really well paced throughout.
Yeah, you could see the two kind of communicate in the corner. And then a spot I always enjoy is like the guy who's selling the knee in Punk takes the Irish whip and he can't run into the opposite corner. His leg just gives out. And then he comes back and he hits the Frankensteiner in the opposite corner. So I guess they wanted to get this Frankensteiner in there. A big month this month for the Steiners. And Penta then stops the GTS with elbows, and it just became this battle for Punk to try and hit this GTS on this guy who had these counters for it. And Punk ends up using a fireman's carry to get away from the armbreaker spot, goes to the Anaconda Vice, and Penta gets his leg on the rope. We see a Fear Factor and Pile Driver by each teased onto the apron, and then Punk with the head kick, springboard clothesline. He calls for the GTS. Once again, Penta catches the leg. The Fear Factor is stopped, and Penta once again takes the arm. He is determined to break this arm. They trade cradles, and then Penta comes off the middle rope into a GTS, landing on the shoulders, and Punk wins in 1337.
The counters that really kind of guided the last half of this, I thought, were very, very well done. I know that, you know, for better or for worse, and certainly the character that Penta is working right now, you know, is so over the top. I feel like, you know, his time in Lucha Underground and elsewhere, you know, he sort of has this reputation for kind of, oh, very kind of gonzo, over the top style matches. But the actual, you know, core psychology and pacing of this, and some very, very logical, well-timed, engaging counters that gave this match structure, I thought really, really worked out well. I did some checking on Cage Match just to confirm that, yeah, CM Punk and Penta never crossed paths before. It is a first time meeting, but I thought it came together very, very well for something that was put together so last minute.
Punk wasn't one of those mysterious disciples of death in Lucha Underground. They didn't come into contact with one another.
Not as far as I could tell. But I mean, we're going to see, you know, at least two more, you know, people who were under masks in Lucha Underground later on in this episode, of course. Yeah.
I really enjoyed this match. I thought it was a great opener. The Punk series that he is at, I just think this guy is working at such a high level. His matches have been so enjoyable, and just the structure of them, and with a very diverse opponent in Penta. Like, you wonder how these styles would have meshed, and it turned out to be really effective. And even if you want to gripe about that Frankensteiner spot, I thought the recovery was pretty well handled, and they had already been establishing the knee story in it on top of that. So Punk gets the victory. And then we go out to an airfield where the Jericho Appreciation Society is arriving on their jet. As they explain, this is how sports entertainers travel. We have Eddie Kingston and Santana and Ortiz, who arrive in a car, and they have beaten up Matt Menard and Ange Parker, stealing Parker's shoes. And this man would not be able to get any replacement shoes for the rest of the night. He would have to come to the arena barefoot. And this was a major takeaway from Santana, Ortiz, and Eddie Kingston as a precursor to our six-man tag later.
Clearly doesn't have the Bucks hookup, you know. I mean, every Monday, you know, we see them just, you know, with extra and extra pairs and pairs and pairs of kicks, you know, and I guess none could be spared for 2.0 here. Yeah, it was a fun little segment. You know, I like the whole kind of grimy street idea of just like, we're going to take your shoes, twist your thumbs, and then throw you out on the street in front of your boys to set the match up.
Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus took on Red Dragon for the AEW Tag Team Championships. This turned into a very fun match. We had O'Reilly sliding right into Luchasaurus's knee. This is after they had been getting the heat on Luchasaurus, so he got out of the corner. Jungle Boy gets in, multiple tope suicidas until they retreat to the other side of the ring, allowing Luchasaurus to hit a moonsault to the floor. And then they go after Luchasaurus's knee. So a lot of knee damage throughout this program already. They work over the knee. Then they follow on Jungle Boy's knee with a dragon screw and an arm wringer off the apron. Jungle Boy hit an elbow off the top as Fish is being held in the side slam position. Very hot crowd for this as they're getting into near falls. And double team Jungle Boy. O'Reilly is threatening with the arm breaker. And then O'Reilly applies a jumping guillotine. So he's got Luchasaurus in the guillotine as Fish and Jungle Boy are on the top turnbuckle, and Fish executes an avalanche Falcon Arrow going over O'Reilly and Luchasaurus. That was a massive near fall that this crowd just got to their feet from. And then O'Reilly is sent out of the ring after the tail whip, and they finish off Bobby Fish with the Thoracic Express, and Jungle Boy gets the pin, and they retain the tag titles. I was curious if they would actually execute the title change here, but this was, I mean, we were 2 for 2 on matches here.
Oh, definitely. There was just before that crazy avalanche spot, there was that kind of rolling butterfly suplex into an assisted German spot that was very, very impressive. Exactly the sort of kind of like, you know, fluid moving combos that you'd expect from Red Dragon, especially in the closing section of the match. But yeah, to your point, I was kind of predicting that Red Dragon would take this. I was sort of anticipating that, you know, you'd want to play the hot hand with FTR as the babyface is chasing the belts, and that therefore having the belts on Red Dragon as, you know, a really formidable heel team would make sense. But, you know, in the post-match, it doesn't necessarily look like we're going in that direction. But yeah, another fantastic match that I thought was paced well. Obviously, this one got a lot more kind of AEW spot heavy towards the end, but still very, very entertaining throughout.
And what do you see as the path for Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus? Like, do you see them kind of just being in this mix here? Like, they FTR came out afterwards and held up their tag titles, indicating something with Red Dragon. And I guess we will see where Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus fit into this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus have had a number of title defenses against some of the, you know, the smaller or less high profile teams. Dark Order, Private Party, Gun Club, The Acclaimed. If they aren't going to be going into a program with FTR, I'm not really 100% sure. And they do need, I feel like they kind of need something to kind of be kind of reinvigorated, right? As you and Wei have been sort of talking about for the last week or so, especially after this incredible surge that FTR have been happening, it's been really easy to kind of allow them to slip into the back. That's not the worst thing in the world necessarily. You know, I think we know that this is probably not going to be the only title reign they have. And we all, of course, know that, you know, Jack Perry's future with the company is not as a tag wrestler, probably in the long term. But yeah, I do think it would be important to give them something to really sink their teeth into if it isn't going to be connected to FTR or Red Dragon.
But FTR was out here. They held up their both the AAA and ROH tag titles and just got into a shoving match with Red Dragon. So to be continued on the tag front. They recapped Yuta and Moxley, which I thought was important to at least spend at least a little bit of time reflecting on that match on Friday. And that took us to Tony Schiavone with the Blackpool Combat Club. And they are taking on the Gun Club on Rampage, which might be like the perfect trios pairing for the Blackpool Combat Club's first match as a threesome. Danielson said that Yuta and Moxley bled together. This man spit in my face. Now we will all fight together. I think that's that's a bonding experience.
And you're right. There's some very punchable faces in the Gun Club just waiting to have the crap kicked out of them across the ring from them soon. The thing that stuck out to me in this was when Moxley said, "Time to get mean, Wheeler." We've seen, and certainly obviously last Friday, we saw Yuta be able to endure pain and to kind of like fight and grit his way through it. But I think the question is, can he seem sadistic? Can he seem threatening in the way that Regal has been talking about the other two members of the club, and that obviously those two guys are more than capable of really turning on that really, really aggressive, nasty, and mean streak within their offense. That is maybe, I think, more so than the kind of the plucky, never give up, never say die, I'll bleed till I'm passed out position that Yuta is in. It's whether or not he can really start showing off that much more mean and aggressive offensive side in the short term, I think.
Yeah, Moxley just added that the Gun Club are goofs. We need to bust their faces open and get rid of them. And Yuta noting that the real work begins on Friday. So it's going to be interesting to see on Rampage because, you know, going into tonight, we only had the Texas Deathmatch announcement. And I was curious if that was going to take up a large part of the hour on Friday. But we do have three matches. But I would imagine the lion's share of that show will be dedicated to the title match. Which,
yeah,
for you, is it not airing at like 4 in the afternoon?
It is. Luckily, I'm on vacation pretty much as of like Friday morning. So I'll probably be able to watch that one live, although it might be going to head-to-head against the Blue Jays game. I'm not 100% sure. So maybe some decisions to be made there.
That is quite the conflict to have with this show at 4 in the afternoon on the West Coast.
Yep.
We had a promo spot with Tony Storm and Jamie Hayter. They're going to meet in the first round of the Owen Hart tournament, and Hayter just said she's going to break Storm's face. She smiled and walked off. So there you have it. They're at least, you know, building up this with some promos after last week and following it again this week.
And one of the only mentions of actual Owen Hart in connection to the Owen Hart tournament, Hayter saying that she's honed her skills, or both of them have honed their skills in Japan and Europe like Owen did. That's been a little kind of minor gripe of mine through the opening stages of the both brackets of the Owen tournament is I just kind of want these people talking a little bit about what this tournament is, what it means, what Owen Hart means to them, memories of Owen Hart. Just a little bit more of that, I think, would be nice. But obviously on paper, this is a fantastic match one way or the other.
The next match was MJF, who was out with Sean Spears, taking on Captain Sean Dean, who had a t-shirt on, "I beat you." And the match begins, and they explain that security is all around the arena and all around the ring to prevent Wardlow from getting involved. But the second this bell rings, this whole arena erupts in chants of Wardlow. They have really just backdoored into something incredible. I'm sure they had their sights set on something approximating this, but it has to have exceeded expectations of how much their audiences city to city have taken to this.
I mean, obviously MJF, as you know, being such a despicable heel and playing this, you know, cruel, tyrannical employer, that starts this off. But kind of just the pure physical charisma that Wardlow has been able to communicate in pursuit of him, you know, it's his ball to run with, and he's absolutely doing it. I don't know if you happened to catch that it kind of went viral a couple of days ago, the video from the Japanese call of last week's Dynamite with Shingo Takagi sort of expressing his excitement and approval at Wardlow shredding his way through the security last week, which was very charming and very entertaining. It's impossible not to love this guy.
Yeah, I think that if Shingo is a regular on those Japanese versions, I think that is something that they should actually get some of those clips like circulating and stuff. I did see the call that they had for the end of FTR and the Young Bucks, so very cool to see it with the Japanese commentary over it. MJF is like he's having trouble unzipping his jacket, and this is all just a ploy to sneak attack Dean from behind. Then he takes the jacket off. He's posing, and then we go to the back, and it's just like some action film where the security are dead on the floor. They're unconscious. MJF is extremely worried, and he continues to attack Dean on the floor, runs him into the barricade, and as MJF is leaning with his back towards the barricade, a security member who had a mask on shows up and reveals himself to be Wardlow, and MJF turns around and he runs in fear, and Wardlow is going after MJF. Sean Spears comes from behind with a chair shot that is completely no-sold, and then he goes to powerbomb Spears when an army, and I mean an army of security, come down. There had to have been at least a dozen guys down here to stop him. This poor dude sacrificed his spine taking this apron bomb, and then with this wall of security holding Wardlow, MJF cannot navigate around to get into the ring, so Bryce Remsburg gets to 9, and then MJF tries to bribe Bryce by stating, whatever Tony Khan pays you, I will pay you triple as long as you don't count 10. He considers it and then counts 10. And Sean Dean is now 2-0 against MJF. I thought this was great.
Finding these clever ways of weaving not just the Sean Dean story, but also, of course, the contract story with Wardlow into in-ring is going to be, you know, it's an interesting creative challenge for them, and they're finding some cool ways of doing it. Do you remember the whole, like, tower defense video game craze of about 10 years ago, John, like Plants versus Zombies?
Not really.
It was the idea is that, you know, you're trying to build up a wall of defense and just fight off wave after wave after wave of attackers and holding out for X amount of time. And that's basically what Wardlow was doing here, right? Just, can I just stand here and hold the line for a count of 10 to ensure that Max gets screwed over? Just a really fun way of telling a count out story that is so different from a lot of the usual, just, you know, heel begging off or grabbing his belt and running and then being dragged in, you know, or even the Yano being tied to the barricade sort of spots. Coming up with a fresh or fun way of doing a count out spot is pretty difficult, but they did it here.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that it's done so sparingly in AEW that, you know, when it's done, it's, you don't groan at it. The furthest thing from it, like this worked so well to this audience, and it was almost just this, can they do it in such a clever way? And I mean, this crowd was going just ballistic for this entire thing built around Wardlow. And we go to the back, and Wardlow has destroyed more of the security that had taken him to the back. And he says he will not stop until he gets his hands on MJF and he is released from his contract. So this, at its core, this is a labor rights story.
Exactly. We've got Starbucks and Amazon unionizing, all manner of, you know, workers' rights movements cropping up all across the U.S. right now. And as we're going to find out later on, you know, Wardlow's contract, not necessarily the most worker friendly, right? All manner of unpleasant overtime and unsafe working conditions that he's going to be forced to endure.
Yes, more on that to come. We had a Darby Allin video in black and white where he's skating down a street, and we see kind of the outline of a coffin, and he is challenging Andrade to a coffin match, and that will take place next Wednesday on the program. So I guess this will be the blow off to this program, we assume.
Has to be at this point. I mean, it's been perfectly enjoyable. I mean, that one match in particular, I know everybody really, really liked. But it does sort of feel like it's one that is kind of running its course. And, you know, there's probably other things for both guys to do.
There was this promo from Malakai Black about killing the deepest part of your soul. And you may ask why I'm alone tonight. That's because I want you to fear the shadows. If you can translate any of this promo for me, Bruce, have at it, because this, it was like, it's almost like there's like a filter on his audio where it sounds like he's talking underwater on top of it. So this is not the easiest promo to decipher.
I try to meet Malakai Black halfway on most of the promos. You know, look, I'm somebody with a, you know, English literature degrees. I teach, you know, college level English and whatnot. I read a lot of frou-frou poetry and everything like that. I'm willing to meet you halfway on some, you know, kind of extended metaphors and whatnot. I gave up on this one. This was all over the place. I really was not envying you having to try to think about transcribing this one.
Yeah, this was one to me. It's just you've got to meet me a third of the way by me being able to understand what is coming out of your mouth. But this was not exactly a hit. And then we have a new take for the Jericho Appreciation Society for their introduction. First, we get over the speakers with Matt Menard saying, "The Jericho Appreciation Society, for over 5 weeks, the recognized symbol of excellence in sports entertainment." That then takes us into Judas. So they come out and they are met by Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz. And Eddie Kingston coming out with a thump shirt, which he was smart enough to tweet ahead of time that it says thump. Because if you look at the font on this, especially for people that maybe were not at home and couldn't get a glance at it, it could certainly have looked like another word.
Especially when you factor in the wag with the the little Brandon sign at the front here. I think Twitter seemed to be very, very concerned about this for a moment. But thankfully, no, we're not getting the heel turn that absolutely nobody would expect and nobody would want from Eddie today.
Yeah, you were. You mentioned the sign, and there was a lot of complaints about the sign that was visible there in the front row for, I would say, three quarters of the show up until the main event. So I don't know if they removed the sign, but it was visible there for most of the show. One of my favorite parts of this entrance was Ortiz coming down, and he's got Parker's shoes tied around his neck, and he goes into the camera and he just yells, "Your shoes!" Like, just this announcement that I have your property, just in case you're not sure about this. So they fight on the floor. Everyone is all over the place, and they go through the break. Jericho misses on a lion salt, and they get the heat on Ortiz, who is crawling and crawling. The crowd is going nuts for Eddie, but then he gets cut off by Garcia, finally makes the tag. Santana's in later with the Three Amigos and Frog Splash. Kingston hits a tope suicida onto Jake Hager. They set up for the street sweeper when Ortiz hits a tope con hilo onto Matt Menard and Ange Parker, who come down to ringside. Ange Parker, sans shoes. And then Kingston is in with Garcia. Hurricane doesn't connect. And then Jericho from the floor nails him with the bat. And this leads to Daniel Garcia pinning Eddie Kingston in 11 minutes and 45 seconds. And a post-match beatdown with the bat with Parker still without shoes. I don't think he reclaimed the shoes either.
No, it didn't look like that. I mean, and, you know, I can see this being a little running bit, at least in the early stages of this feud. I mean, I think we all were presuming by the placement of this one that, you know, this is the beginning of a program that's going to be going on for a while in lots of different permutations and matches. I thought the match itself was pretty damn enjoyable. It was kind of fast moving enough that I didn't feel like any one particular person kind of got a moment to shine. I'm very interested in seeing how Garcia is going to kind of fit into the Jericho and Hagar milieu in terms of actual match construction moving forward. But, you know, when you've got a story that I think resonated with people so much, the promos that Eddie was cutting in the pre-tape vignettes and whatnot were characteristically fantastic. You know, it's a slightly different type of story that they're telling with Kingston compared to, you know, the Moxley one, which was, so much more longstanding. Just this idea of Jericho just kind of screwing up by tapping into just the completely untamed, violent, animalistic side of Kingston is something that I have a lot of time for. And I mean, I don't know, where do you think this is going? Like, maybe, I don't know, like a blood and guts type match, if they can get two more people onto Kingston's team. I don't know that Stadium Stampede is really the right fit.
Yeah. I don't know if they go to, a Stadium Stampede. I don't think so. Blood and guts, I mean, you've had them state that they're expecting to do it again. This is a program that you could definitely do it for at some point. And yeah, perhaps you do add more to the number side for Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz. Does anyone come to mind to you that would fit in there? I'll say that, you know, someone who I think is definitely falling off the path right now is a Sammy Guevara, that if in the right situation, I would weave him into this. That would be kind of on Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz's side, although I see that as a tough fit right now. I think that you would have to do some work to make that fit. But I just see Sammy Guevara, to me, is someone that is just in this weird area right now where I just don't know where they're going with him.
Yeah, the crowd is beginning to turn, as apparently we were hearing about the crowd altering happening last Friday, I think it was. You know, it's one of those cases where you have the heels, don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but it's one of those cases where you have the heels cutting promos against them, and you have a sizable portion of the audience kind of going, they got a point, and that's a difficult thing.
Yeah, what right now, like, he I think would affect Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz. Like, it's not a fit right now. I'm just saying, as somebody that if they could, if this were Guevara of like 2 months ago, you know, he has the history with the Inner Circle, but I just look at him as someone that they're like that's a character I would want to focus on right now, because he's going into a direction that I don't think they should be going with him.
Yeah, and we'll see if they change it. One just quick comment about the whole Kingston and Inner Circle breakup. I do want to see at some point Santana speak on the whole situation. He hasn't really done so since the attack on himself and Ortiz. Obviously, you know, when you're standing beside Kingston, it's difficult to get a word in or, you know, seem like, you know, you're a great talker or whatever. But Santana really is. He's a wonderfully, I think, underrated and an underutilized promo talent who's been able to make really personal connections to in-ring stories. And I think, you know, the dissolution of the Inner Circle and the betrayal of Jericho and whatnot, that's something I really want to hear from him about.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So after that, we go to the back. This was actually a good setup. Like, Alex Marvez is just laughing about another upset win tonight, and MJF is standing there just livid. I thought this was one of the best things Alex Marvez, like, it was just a night. It was just a funny moment where he's laughing about this, and MJF, it just sets him off. He screams. He is the prodigy, the phenom, but he understands there is no sympathy for the devil. I don't need your sympathy because I have money. And there is Mark Sterling, who has the contract, and MJF has the right to book or not book Wardlow against whoever he wants. And he is going to put Wardlow to work, and he is going to slaughter that greedy pig, and he pays off Jose, the translator, for the services of the butcher. So it will be Wardlow and the butcher.
We had the, you know, whatever it was, the five tasks of Jericho or the five labors of Jericho. We're clearly going to be getting something quite similar for Wardlow here. I thought MJF came off fantastically, as you'd expect. He seemed more physically angry in a way than more so than he normally is. Quick little note about MJF. I want to give a quick shout out to my Postmarks co-host David Myers for the really excellent interview he did with MJF in the Alja Minor, specifically talking about MJF's experiences with anti-Semitism in the wrestling business. So if you haven't read that yet, look it up and give it a read. It's well worth your time.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very enlightening read as well, just to hear, you know, there were elements of that in that a very well-remembered promo that MJF did not too long ago, but going into his, you know, experiences on the independent scene where he experienced that. And it's awful to read about, but also, you know, important to read that that kind of thing was happening. Mm-hmm. So Marina Shafir against Sky Blue. So Sterling is scouting in the back while Jade is just on her phone. And we see the baddie section, which features Red Velvet and Kiera Hogan in there for whatever reason.
Is this a heel turn for them? I mean, I've been tracking, you know, I'm one of those guys who watches Dark and everything like that. And apart from, you know, Velvet getting that, you know, kind of heel reaction in response to Willow Nightingale being kind of the hometown favorite, there's been no real precursor to this at all. And it seemed like a weird time to have this happen while you have a wrestler debuting on television in Shafir.
Yeah, for this one, I mean, this was kind of the big showcase for Marina Shafir on Dynamite to build up this, you know, this 30th match for Jade Cargill. It was one that, like, the audience just seemed not into this one. It went 2.5 minutes. Blue jumps for a guillotine and gets tossed to the mat. There's a pump handle suplex. The baddie section is like goading Shafir, who then rolls Blue into this triangle submission and gets the tap at 2 minutes and 23 seconds. This one, to me, like, I understood what they were trying to do, and maybe it was just, it wasn't the opponent that the, maybe they thought the audience would be more into Sky Blue, but it was, to me, just not kind of the dynamic outing that you needed for a Shafir to have that sets her up as this big threat for Jade Cargill. And I would say watching this, I expect when that match takes place, that's going to be a very pro Jade Cargill crowd that the audience is going to be behind. And maybe that's what they want. But this to me was a segment that this was one of the rare segments that this audience was not that into.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm someone who's really interested in Shafir. Like, I don't think she's, you know, like a can't miss, you know, oh, was underutilized in the WWE and now, you know, she's going to be a megastar in AEW. I don't think it's that cut and dry in her case, but there's a lot of things that are unique and interesting about her. You know, some of her matches on the independents, you know, at Bloodsport have been great, others not so much. There's interesting things that you can do with her, but I just sort of felt there were so many other parts. Even leaving aside a kind of a cold crowd, you had Cargill in the back. You had the baddies section. You know,
there's a lot going on for a 2-minute match.
The focus seemed everywhere except on her. I would have just, if you want to do the match with Blue, have her just come in here and just more quickly and violently immediately dispatch her, like without even the pretense of it being competitive, and then go on to do whatever it is you're going to be doing with Jade or the baddies or whatever it is. As it is, just a lot going on, and the spotlight wasn't really on her.
So then we had Lexi Nair with Hook in the back and was trying to get a word with him. Next week, Hook will make his Dynamite debut. And then for the third consecutive segment, we get Mark Sterling, who walks in with Tony Nese, his latest client, and asks why they're not interviewing Nese. And Nese says that Hook was handed his success. So Hook stands up with a medicine ball and Danhausen appears from behind the workout equipment and catches the ball as he's continuing to try and curse Hook. So I guess we'll probably get Danhausen involved. Although they didn't flat out announce Hook and Tony Nese for next week, but that was my impression from watching this segment.
It's got to be coming soon. I like the idea of Danhausen kind of bit by bit beginning to look up to Hook as some, because he is uncursable and therefore admirable, having him follow Hook around like a little puppy trying to be as cool and as badass as he is could be fun. And Mark Sterling, I guess, you know, America's litigious country, John. I don't know what to tell you. Everybody needs a lawyer.
Well, he was well represented on the show. Dan Lambert is with Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky, and they call Sammy Guevara and Ty Conti the most obnoxious couple, and this sets up Sky defending the TNT title against Guevara on Saturday at Battle for the Belts 2 that will be taped on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a match that I think, you know, a rematch that makes a lot of sense. I've been pretty, you know, cautiously happy with the way that the Sky title run has been going up until now. But to our point earlier on, in terms of, you know, where the crowd's sympathies lie and whatnot, you know, talking about the Jade versus Shafir example, I think this is really a case where you could have, you know, the crowd really behind Sky as, you know, this longtime veteran, you know, who was maybe kind of sidelined after the original SCU title run and has bit by bit clawed his way kind of into this, you know, nice kind of mid-card title position that he's in comparison to, you know, the kind of irritating, the kind of obnoxious, you know, kind of extra couple that, you know, we all kind of have in our lives and, you know, just we don't necessarily need to be hearing about or seeing about constantly. I hate to say it, but, you know, real life couples are often unlikable on wrestling television.
You know what I thought was a big mistake? If you are wanting to keep Sammy Guevara as this babyface, the fact that that line was left on Rampage where he said to Ethan Page that, "I don't give a shit about your daughter." Like, what? That's a line to me. Like, you have just given an open door for your audience to totally dismiss this guy by throwing in a line like that. That to me, if you were going to edit anything in that segment, that would be the line I would be just cutting out from my babyface telling a heel, "I don't care about your young daughter."
Well, this they're learning from the WWE, John. You know, the weekly TV is just there to serve as, you know, the footage for the eventual promo package that's going to be put together for the pay-per-view when Sammy is a heel by that point, you know, and then they'll be able to go back to this and draw upon that. Boom, we've got that in the archive there. Sammy Guevara hates children. Wrong for the TNT title, wrong for America.
How do you expect that crowd in Garland, Texas to react to that match? Like, I could certainly see a very pro Scorpio Sky crowd on Friday. I think this is a pretty in tune audience that senses where things are going with this Sammy Guevara character, and I think it's only going to take a portion of that audience to be booing him that I think the arena will follow suit.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, even whatever portion of the crowd might be behind Sammy, just still kind of, you know, out of de facto residual, you know, likability from a few months ago, there's really not been much for them to dig their teeth into, right? It's been a lot of kind of like hit and run, you know, cowardly, haha, we smashed your car up, haha, we expletived, you know, using the belt and everything like that. There hasn't really been much to rally whatever sort of, you know, supporters of Sammy as a babyface there might still be. So yeah, I do expect it to probably be about, I don't know, maybe 60-70% in favor of Scorpio.
Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs, they come out, thunderous reaction. Starks is here in his hometown taking on Swerve Strickland and Keith Lee. And Swerve comes from he is on the top turnbuckle, and he walks over and leaps off the chest of Keith Lee with a moonsault to the floor. This was probably the spot of the show. The precision of which he executed this was incredible.
That was that got a legitimate, like, you know, gasp from me.
And Keith Lee too. I think Keith Lee was just in awe that this man pulled this off to such a degree. I really liked Swerve and Keith Lee as a tag team here. I thought they had a lot of great chemistry as like a babyface tag team here. But they were heavily into Starks and Hobbs throughout this. We have Keith Lee had this leapfrog as Hobbs ducked under that was looked great, and then ends up running into Starks in the corner. Swerve would fake out Hobbs to yank him off the apron, and then does a roll into the ring into a spear from Starks. Starks follows with a Canadian Destroyer. So on this show, we can say on a Dynamite where Ricky Starks and Penta wrestled, Starks had more Canadian Destroyers on this show.
True. Honorary Canadian. Honorary, yes. Canadian.
Ricky Swerve Starks, then sends Starks off the shoulders onto the turnbuckle. He's on the turnbuckle and sends him off his shoulders into a pounce by Lee. Hobbs gets into Lee's face, but he's not the legal man. Taz walks out, leading to a big ECW chant, and Hobbs then gets posted when Swerve pops off the shoulder. Swerve breaks up a cover with a 450, and then Keith Lee roars, runs the ropes where Taz trips him, and leads to a spinebuster by Hobbs, pinning Keith Lee, and they played Starks' music at the end, and they had the hometown guy and Ricky Starks go over here, although it was Hobbs getting the pin.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, that was perfectly fine. I mean, we don't need to rehash, you know, the point that's been made a lot about AEW actually allowing even heels, you know, to win in their own hometowns, you know, to get the crowd over with them. But I mean, this was just a case where you've got four incredibly entertaining wrestlers who the crowd, all of whom was into, just getting to, you know, strut their stuff and work an incredibly fun, fast-paced, very, very entertaining match. I've been really impressed that Hobbs in particular has been kind of able to hold his own kind of charisma and presence-wise alongside, you know, three guys with kind of, you know, louder sorts of personalities and, you know, maybe more established reputations and whatnot. But just everybody was great here. This was really good. I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school when I say that I think there is a huge, huge babyface run for Starks at some point. You know, if you missed him on NWA, you know, that kind of got him in the door. I think with AEW, his face work there was fantastic. That, you know, little just silly bit of improv that he did with RJ City and the limo on the road to Revolution YouTube show showcase that the dude is preternaturally talented and charismatic. But yeah, just a cool homecoming for him, and just a very, very fun match.
And late in the card too, like this was you know, late in the show, and they had a very, very strong outing. And I would like to see Swerve and Keith Lee you know, team, they can have this alliance. They can do like single stuff, but also have a bit of an alliance when necessary. Not that this tag division is lacking at all, but nonetheless, it's like there's another combo you can go to. So here we go, everyone. Get your pencil and paper out. This is what is coming up over the next week on Rampage, the live edition on Friday from Garland, Texas at 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific. We have Hangman Page against Adam Cole in the Texas Deathmatch for the title. The Gun Club against the Blackpool Combat Club. Ruby Soho against Robin Renegade in the Owen Hart qualifier. Then we go to Saturday at 8 o'clock Eastern. We have Thunder Rosa against Nyla Rose for the women's title, Scorpio Sky against Guevara for the TNT title, and Jonathan Gresham versus Dalton Castle for the ROH title out of nowhere.
Getting the boys are going to get some work, I'm guessing. Yeah, no, that was a bit of a surprise to me, but sure, why not? I mean, obviously, we don't necessarily know where things are going to shake out in terms of ROH, but obviously, there's a lot of, you know, ROH veterans that, you know, Tony has their number, and it'll be cool to see them get in the mix as well.
That is broken up by backstage. Thunder Rosa is being interviewed when Nyla and Vicky appear with a cake to celebrate the world's shortest title reign. And Thunder Rosa asks, "Do you think I'm stupid?" To which they both respond, "Yes." And Thunder Rosa shoves the cake into Nyla's face. And then they fight, where Nyla is covered in cake and ends up drilling Thunder Rosa into the equipment case. And she is left laying.
And in a moment that got a legitimate actual laugh out loud to me, from me, barks at Rosa, "Joke's on you, I love cake," which that was fantastic.
Yes, we will see if she gets her cake and eats it too on Saturday. So that was our setup for what is probably the main event of the show on Saturday. And then next week on Dynamite, Wardlow against The Butcher, Hook's debut on Dynamite, the return of Britt Baker, and next week's show is in Pittsburgh, taking on Danielle Camella, the former Vanessa Bourne. That will be another Owen Hart qualifier. And then in a men's Owen Hart qualifier, Kyle O'Reilly against Jungle Boy, which could be a very good match. A coffin match between Andrade and Darby Allin. And Tony Khan has a huge announcement.
Doesn't he always?
Yes.
Get some sleep, man. Seriously. Just put the phone down. Charge it. I don't know. Touch grass.
Maybe he has found all the bots.
I was kind of hoping that would be, I kind of have died down by the time we got to this episode, because just a whole other front to deal with there. Yeah.
So there you go. Everyone's speculation can begin. And then we got a video for the Texas Deathmatch with promos from Paige and Cole. I was glad that this got in there, because later into the show, I was thinking like they really didn't hammer home this Texas Deathmatch, though they at least got a video in at the end. And it was pretty much Cole explaining like he is going to leave everything there because he won't be able to accept if he fails to become AEW champion. So I'm not going to say this has been the biggest title match that they have promoted. But nonetheless, I'm expecting a pretty great match on Friday from these two. It's just a tough week where you're out of your time slot, and it almost seems like you're handicapped to begin with, but we'll see how it performs.
I don't know if it are going on a little bit earlier. I mean, maybe in the cases of some folks, you know, it might help, you know, if they're either are already in for, you know, in and going to bed for the night or going out for the night on a Friday, it might. But I mean, I think a lot of people are sort of recognizing that this is maybe them reacting to, you know, some flagging interest and flagging ratings in Rampage, right? You know, they've been pre-taped. There's been a lot of, well, you know, it's good wrestling, but, you know, we can get good wrestling whenever we want. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are checking it out on Saturday morning or whatever. So, you know, something like this that actually tries to make it appointment viewing makes sense. And yeah, I have absolutely no doubt that once the bell rings, this pairing is going to deliver again.
Yeah, I mean, between this, you're getting Moxley and Danielson wrestling on Friday. So, I mean, it's hardly a rampage. Like, it's a pretty big rampage by its standards. And then the main event, Minoru Suzuki and Samoa Joe for the ROH Television Championship. We've got Bobby Cruz back to announce the television title match. And Sanjay Dutt and Jay Lethal are ringside with Jay Lethal's present that he would have to present to Samoa Joe. So this one starts off with just this unbelievable chop fest from these two. And Samoa Joe was just head to toe red by about 3 minutes into this match. And this crowd, they were going wild as they went from the chops to forearm strikes. Suzuki catches Joe in an armbar in the ropes before it's broken. They go through picture in picture. And Suzuki is going for the gotch, stops, and then says one more time, and they go back to chopping one another. And Suzuki nails a running drop kick. He roars. The crowd cheers. He goes for the gotch, but Joe blocks it and sends him into the corner, and he's fighting for the muscle buster. Suzuki tries to prevent it with a triangle, but Joe breaks free and hits the muscle buster, winning the match in 11 minutes and 38 seconds.
Some matches need a long and brewing story that goes back to shared history going back years, like, you know, Hangman and Cole. Some just need, you know, one hot angle and one fiery promo, like Kingston and Jericho. And sometimes with some matches, you just need to stick two names against each other on a marquee and walk away from it. The hype for this has been off the chart, you know, since it was very, very surreptitiously announced last Friday. But I mean, as Kate pointed out last week, you know, you could have knocked the internet over with a feather as soon as this got announced. Look, this, you know, these are both guys whose, you know, in-ring prime is probably in the rear view at this point. You know, if we're talking about, you know, kind of big ROH Japanese matches, this wasn't going to be Joe Kobashi, but it didn't need to be, right? It just needed to be each of these guys ramming into each other, having that sort of, you know, Kobashi Sasaki type, you know, chops and forearm exchanges to get the crowd worked up. Suzuki is someone who, you know, I think is really interesting when he comes over to North America, right? He's aware of the cachet that he has over here. And I think he sort of kind of, to be frank, kind of adjusts his matches based on what sort of opponent he is facing, and how much respect he has for them, and what kind of the level of the match is, right? He's not necessarily going to be having a prolonged or complex G1 type sort of match or story here, but he is going to, you know, leave it all out there for an opponent like Joe.
And he's also got to do a match with Ishii on Saturday that
has
a pretty high standard that is coming up in a couple of days. Like, that is going to be pretty much a G1 style match. It's kind of what I expect on Saturday. So, you know, the guy does not quite, he does not pace himself on these US tours, but I thought this was a super fun main event. I think this was right at everyone's, would have met everyone's expectations and had a very hot crowd attached to it. I think an expected title change, like, it made sense to put the title on Joe here. And after the match, Dutt and Lethal congratulate him, and Lethal has his box, and he's going to present him with a present, and it wasn't a dick in a box, but it was the middle finger in the box that he presented. And then the lights go out, and they're out, and they come on, and there is 7'3", Satnam Singh, India's first NBA draft pick by the Dallas Mavericks, 52nd overall in 2015. This was a very ballsy move, Bruce, that they wanted to present this guy obviously as a big deal, but it was a near guarantee that you're doing the lights out gimmick with this guy that is not going to get a big lights out type of reaction when the lights come on. Very ballsy.
Especially when, with all of the ROH chaos and uncertainty that's happening right now, you have God knows how many free agents, you know, possible signings. I mean, you know, my brain was going towards Castagnoli, you know, 3 seconds into the lights out spot. You know, who is it? Who is
it? I'm sure many people were thinking that, yeah.
You know, and it's some guy I have never seen before in my life. And, you know, like, okay, fine, he's physically imposing, but the immediate physicality that we got from him immediately afterwards was not anything notable or remarkable in any way. It was really, you know, Lethal and Dutt kind of actually doing the work and the angle here. You know, you're coming off of a match with two absolute, you know, kind of first ballot type legends in Samoa Joe and Minoru Suzuki. You have all of these questions about ROH. You have AEW presenting itself as the wrestling company, right? That, you know, values and prioritizes veterans, legends, acknowledges their background, their history, their work with other companies. And you use this one spot after a pretty high profile, you know, probably going to be one of the three or four biggest dynamites of the year. And you use this spot to debut, by all accounts, a completely green giant. And ballsy is one word for it, John. But yeah, let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was presented like this is like Sanjay Dutt's protege. And, Yeah, this is going to be one where I think you look at the, you know, AEW, they have taken some talent from scratch and had, you know, relative success with, given like the you know, the experience level. But this is certainly a test where this company, I would say, in if we're comparing this to a WWE or an Omos, I don't think the bar is anywhere near as high as it's going to be to a discerning regular AEW consumer. Like the idea of Joe and this guy having a match, that's a pretty ambitious ask of your audience of what you can do with someone that has not done wrestling and is going to be limited in terms of, you know, being a 7'3" athlete.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, obviously none of us have seen this guy, you know, do any in-ring work, because as far as I could tell, he has not had any recorded or televised matches at all, you know, from his time in the Performance Center. I think Wikipedia says he got there in 2017, and he was, you know, signed by AEW back in September of last year. But yeah, I mean, the Omos comparison, I think, is the one that immediately shot to a lot of folks' minds, myself included. And you've seen even the company that theoretically wants to get behind, you know, somebody like that, how that's kind of withered on the vine in the last, you know, few weeks, you know, after the big match. And so, if we're talking about somebody who's had, you know, maybe less time within the company, and again, to the point about the standard that the AEW audience has for actual in-ring product, this is a very, very, very difficult road to hoe, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a tough one for them. I think he has to be limited in how you utilize him. So this is going to be a big test for them. And, you know, you put him in a situation where, like, you knew that this was not going to get kind of the big surprise pop, but they put them into that situation. So do you see this kind of being Joe's focus for the time being with, like, the Lethal Dutt, Satnam Singh faction, for lack of a better term?
I mean, I guess I have to, like, it's a hell of a lot to wedge into a pretty, pretty crammed AEW, you know, dance card at this point. I was sort of, again, like a lot of people, I was sort of thinking, oh, this is going to be some sort of spinoff into ROH. But then does having this guy in ROH make any more sense? I mean, sure, fine. I guess we'll see if, you know, if Joe can carry this guy for a few minutes or not.
You've got Joe in the Owen tournament as well.
Yeah.
So you have that to juggle as well.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Tonight's Dynamite overall, your thoughts. It was, I thought there were some misses on this show, but I would say that the wrestling quality was pretty high, and the amount of time that they spent on wrestling on this show, like, this was, it was incredible what they worked into a 2 hour and 2 minute show. We did have the 2 minute overrun.
Yeah, I think the overrun kind of maybe got a little bit blown up by the hype machine today, but you know, it was fine at the end for what it was. But yeah, no, my thoughts are pretty much the same, that this was a very, very wrestling focused show, and pretty much the kind of the promos and the couple of angles that were shot were able to get what they needed to get done in a pretty, you know, tight and precise and concise sort of manner, and keeping the focus on the in-ring, which, yeah, was very, very entertaining. You know, I think we were kind of bookended not just by, you know, one match at the beginning and one match at the end, but by, you know, two pretty great matches at the beginning and two pretty great matches at the end. So yeah, lots of in-ring stuff to recommend this episode of Dynamite.
Yeah, I thought it was a strong show and a very hot crowd in New Orleans. So we take one super chat here from John. This might be a deep cut, but at this point for me, Tony Khan teasing an overrun is equivalent to Paul Rudd and Mac and me on Conan O'Brien. At this point, I hope they never overrun.
I appreciate that reference, John. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I don't know why the need for this overrun, if it was, like, obviously it was some kind of a strategy for them. I don't know if it was just to build, like, the next show or what. It was obviously, they did not need the overrun, but they did use 2 extra minutes for whatever reason.
Maybe it was just for us to think that the lights out spot would be something that would, I don't know, maybe lead to more physicality or another match or something like that. Or, hey, you know, maybe this is the proof right here. Maybe it's just us talking about it. Maybe that's the only purpose of it.
The purpose was for many, many people in Canada to tweet me and ask me if this was going to affect Dynamite in Canada tonight.
I was saying to Kate, you know, you've kind of this is the problem. You do something well once that you're not actually interested in doing or that is not your job. And then all of a sudden, you're the person responsible for all of these people's television programming. And
I've become TV guide for everyone.
Yeah.
We do have some feedback here, Bruce, so we will go to forum.postwrestling.com. First one comes from Brian in New Jersey. The debut of Satnam Singh as a heavy for Lethal and Dutt did not instill confidence in me for Lethal's feud with Joe. I thought it was a bad way to follow up such a hot main event and hot show overall. I don't want to overlook all of the highlights this episode provided, for the tag title match, to Ricky Stark's massive hometown hero reaction and subsequent match, and to the continuation of the Wardlow story. Relieved that Punk and Penta recovered from that scary top rope spot and finished their match well. I think like that's you know, that was the big angle to close the show, and I think people are going to have a lot of their opinion on the show on that final angle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was, you know, right up until that last moment, you know, this was a very, very entertaining and in-ring focused show. And so, but, you know, the fact that, you know, our first comment from Brian begins with that, fine. It's, you know, it's maybe recency bias because it's the thing that just happened. But yeah, it might be what is on folks' minds. We go next to Patrick. The show moved along at a rapid pace, but pretty much delivered across the board apart from some hiccups. Loved the Tori Jamie segment, as it felt like a strong way to build this match towards something special. I thought this was a great direction for the women's division. Marina versus Sky was a match that existed, sure. It was nice to see Kier Hogan in Red Velvet seemingly aligned with Jade, but thought having Cargo out after the match to confront Marina would have done more to make this feel important. This is a faction I'd love to see Sunny Kiss get added down the line. Yeah, sure, maybe. Lee and Swerve versus Hobbs and Starks was my match of the night, with all four men making great cases at being main event stars in AEW. I was worried that when Taz came out that we were getting a Swerve with him turning. I was wondering about that too, actually, but happy to see Team Taz get the victory. Surreal to see Joe battle Suzuki. The match was good fun, but the post-match just felt weird. Using the lights out, lights on indicated a huge surprise, but nobody knew who Singh was. Any guesses as to what Tony's huge announcement would be? Patrick is speculating about a New Japan crossover. Yeah, could be that, but I mean, we've seen, you know, for better or for worse, Tony's surprises not always necessarily hitting at the same level in terms of impact or interest to the wrestling audience.
Yeah, I do think it's one that, especially because the Ring of Honor announcement is so fresh in people's memories, that, you know, you put this out there. Again, it's like I always say, when you throw out these things, you are giving permission for your audience to go wild with their ideas of how big it can be. So you better have something that can deliver, because you're going to have 7 days of speculation, and you're coming off what was a pretty major announcement of the purchase of Ring of Honor. So I think it has to be like, that's kind of the bar you set when you tease these announcements, that people are going to think in the direction of, you know, a massive deal for the company, interpromotional stuff, something in that sense, yeah. That people will think about. We go to Andrew from St. John. This was a really fun show with great matches until the end, which seemed intended to build hype to a guy nobody recognized and end with heat. I've got no time for Jay Lethal for speaking out reasons, so I was already grumpy. Satnam Singh will be great, but the lights out reveal didn't work here. The match itself was good also. Also, I love the closing stretch of Penta and Punk, as well as the Eddie Jericho Appreciation Society tag. Sad that on a show that found time for so many matches, the women still only got a short squash match, and that was it. 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, we've got obviously, you know, Hayter and Tony to look forward to. But yeah, given that there were so many eyes on, I think, this Dynamite, I, you know, would speculate that this will maybe do a pretty decent number by Dynamite standards. Yeah, it might have been nice to have something a little bit more high profile there. Muggin is up next. New Orleans was lively from start to finish. However, the Shafir Blue match was dead quiet, and the post-match angle with Lethal and Joe didn't justify the overrun. That being said, the rest of the show was entertaining. Joe Suzuki was very fun. Punk Penta was dope, despite that scary botch. Team Taz versus Lee and Swerve and Jurassic Express Red Dragon were well worked. AEW's habit of not letting things breathe is an issue. Yeah, I was sort of thinking, John, you know, you're in Way's comments about, you know, the pacing when it comes to, you know, writing notes down and reviewing and whatnot. I kind of felt like I was staying on top of things right until the Malachi Black promo, and then I felt like I was just constantly playing catch up in terms of jotting notes down.
Yeah, tonight's kind of an incomplete for me, because I had, with running this and everything, my head was already spinning, so I can't put it all just on Dynamite tonight. there was the one episode maybe a month or so ago when I came on here and it was just, it was way too much. It was to me like the peak of like dynamite of just,
yeah, I remember that
like,
one. Yeah.
I was out of breath after watching that episode. Last word of the night goes to Kate, who says, loads of fun tonight, marred by a flat ending. It was hard to tell who was the most over because the crowd seemed hot for a lot of people. But I think the biggest pop of the night might have gone to Wardlow. I think my favorite match was Team Taz against Swerve and Lee, which was just spectacular. All four men felt like stars, and it seemed like the crowd, while they wanted to cheer the hometown anti-hero, was into everything. I was thinking that the tag belts might change hands tonight, but it seems like Red Dragon are shifting focus to the ROH ones. Do you see more titles changing hands this week, or is Joe the only and new? So I guess we're looking at the AEW title match on Friday, and then Saturday we've got three title matches. Of those four, can you see any title changes, Bruce?
I don't see the men's world changing. I don't see the women's world changing. I mean, if
the ROH title, I don't think that one's changing.
No. I don't think that one's going anywhere.
Guevara winning back the TNT title is...
If they decide to kind of steer into the curve and carry Sammy over into a heel direction, then yes. I would sort of feel a little bit bad for Sky because I do think that he has been really good in this spot. I think, you know, bit by bit, the promos with, you know, he and Paige are no longer necessarily being as overshadowed by Lambert as they used to be. So I would kind of hate to cut short what has been a pretty rewarding and interesting title run from Sky. But again, if they are going to, you know, maybe switch the program up with Sammy, then yeah, having, you know, Ty Conti interfere in some way or whatever and get the title back to him, you know, that'll complete that turn for him. So that's the only one that I can possibly see moving.
Yeah, I'm going to go with none. I don't think we'll get any to change. I think it would be early. I think you're just getting started with Scorpio Sky. I would hate to them just kind of take the rug out from underneath him that this early in the way things are going. But we'll see. Maybe they have some left field idea for any four of those matches. So that is coming up this week. And Bruce is going to have a report on the site on Saturday night because you will be watching the Windy City Riot from Villa Park, Illinois, which is a pretty loaded show. And John Moxley will be going head to head with AEW on Saturday night.
That's true. Head to head with his own company. Yeah, this is just one of those weird things that comes with obviously AEW and NJPW having the working relationship that they do. But it's a pretty exciting card. Lots of stuff on it, including Scott Norton, of all people, just, you know, for his first match in 3 or 4 years, something like that. And also the today or yesterday, the just formally announced with NJPW Chris Dickinson appearing on that card as well.
That's right. John Moxley against Will Ospreay in the main event, Ishii against Minoru Suzuki, the US of J Open Challenge, Finn Juice and Brody King against Jonah, Shane Haste, and Bad Dude Tito. Those are Yuji Nagata against Tom Lawler on this show. So it looks like a pretty solid card for Saturday night, and that goes along with Battle of the Belts. So another quiet weekend in pro wrestling, Bruce.
And then there's Strong to throw in there that's going, I think, head-to-head with both of those shows as well.
There's New Japan. They're running competition with themselves, so that's always wise. Well, I want to thank you so much for jumping in, Bruce. It's great to... I don't know if you and I have ever done a show together.
No. The 3 or 4 times that I have done the fill-in, it's always been with you taking some time off rather than away. So I was really, really glad to be able to get to do this with you specifically.
Well, maybe we can do it some other time. I've got to recruit someone for Monday night for Raw, and it's a very tough ask. I'm not going to request that from you. But yes, I will be back on Thursday, and I want to make note for Thursday's post daily news show. I'm going to be doing a bit of a different format where I'll be going through all of the news, and I'll be posting the video up, which will be up now if you're listening to the show. If you've downloaded the show, and I will be taking questions on the show. So if you want to post questions, post them in the comments section, and I will take time at the end of the daily news show to go through questions. So going to try that out on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We'll also be dropping the British Wrestling Experience, and then no daily news show on Friday. It is a holiday here in Canada, so no daily news show, but I will be back Friday night with Kate from Montreal to chat Rampage and SmackDown at 10:05 p.m. Eastern time. So AEW is getting us on an hour earlier. So that is a thank you from us to AEW. But Bruce, before we go, where can people go follow any of your work?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Contrasoma. That's Contrasoma. Fair warning, going to be a lot of Blue Jays talk on there for the foreseeable future, especially if Lodito is going to keep having three homer games like he did today. I alluded to Postmarks, the podcast that I run with David Myers a little bit earlier in the episode. Our new episode will be out this Saturday. I think it's the 6th of the interviews that we have done with members of the post-wrestling community. You hear his voice every Tuesday morning and occasionally when he drops by on Friday to freestyle. But how much do you actually know about Colby John himself, the man behind the Hot 16s? We had a fun chat with him talking about wrestling, parenting, all sorts of stuff. That'll be out on Saturday. My main hustle remains idieudie.com, a website where myself and my partner Alex write about industrial goth, darkwave music. It's also the home of our We Have a Technical podcast. We recently celebrated our 400th episode where we had a number of guests, writers, musicians, and podcasters, including Post's own Wei Ting, who don't normally listen to that sort of music, drop by and offer their thoughts on some tracks that we selected for them. So if you've ever found yourself listening to Post and you found yourself wondering, gee, I wonder what Wei thinks about the music of foundational electro-industrial band Skinny Puppy, then oh boy, do I have a podcast for you? So again, that is all over at idieudie.com.
Perfect. I think that's a question on the top of everyone's mind, so they can go check that out and find that answer. So I want to thank Bruce for joining us tonight and everyone that joined us live tonight on YouTube or downloaded the show afterwards. We'll be back on Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern time with the Post Daily News Show, and that will complete Rewind to Dynamite.